So when I was looking at the material for this paper, I was struck by two sets of dates, which have an almost exact correlation. Between 1820 and 1935, the Royal Academy didn't elect a single full woman academician. And the archive I'm working on, which runs between 1820 and 1939, has almost just over 25% female account holders. So the Robeson Archive, which is the papers of the artist Cullman, Charles Robeson and co., has a very different picture of artistic practice and activity of women than the Academy would suggest. And this is just to give you an idea of what the archive looks like in case any of you happen to come and visit me at any point. The archive is housed in the Hamilton Carr Institute in Cambridge, contains over 2,000 women's accounts. And although it can't be seen as a fully representative example of women's artistic activity, there are obviously other companies, notably Windsor & Newton. We also have their archive. Unfortunately, it doesn't have any of their customer records. In many ways, it's a self-selected sample. It had economic barriers to become an account holder, and it's obviously very influenced by being located in London. But this is often something that women artists say is critical to their careers. You know, they need to choose to be an artist, they need the money to be able to be an artist, and they often need to locate to the capital. I'm not sure which button to press to get the next one.
Arrow keys.
Just
the arrow
keys. Okay. Nope. Sorry, which one?
That's okay, if you want.
Oh, it's there.
Those.
Sorry, that's under the drawer. That's lovely, yeah, thank you. Sure. Emily Mary Osborne, patron of Nameless and Friendless that you see here, saw her family's move to the capital as offering her a chance to pursue her career as an artist. And there she found a place to train, opportunities to exhibit, and also from the age of 26 until she was 74, a place to buy painting materials through her account with Charles Robeson. While the Robeson Archive is an imperfect sample, it's one of considerable duration, detail and variety. And when you look at the... that's her account, just to show you what sort of information the archive contains. When you look at new accounts opened by women between 1820 and 1939, it's clear that the period 1851 to 1918 that we're discussing today does indeed encompass a period of opportunity for women artists. There is a clear increase in women's activity, as you can see that massive peak around the 1870s, but it appears relatively short-lived, the curve of the graph suggesting that the golden age was not to last. The 19th century peak of 99 new accounts in 1872 had dropped to single figures by the start of the 20th century, and understandably during the war years of 14 to 18, a total of only 9 accounts were opened. This peak and decline is not confined to women artists. The market as a whole was starting to feel the effects of depression towards the end of the century, and data on picture prices suggest that they began to rise in the 1850s, peaked around the 1870s, and then began a steady decline, prices for contemporary artists in Britain. So it appears from the information offered in the Robeson Archive that female as well as male artists were able to capitalise on this rising market, but would also eventually share in its decline. And so I think the pattern of new female account holders suggests that if you're looking for women artists as a group and you're hoping to find them appearing in the historical record in any numbers, you'd be best to look on either side of about 1870. The number of female account holders in the archive would actually be larger if they had accounts under their own names. Many of them are under their father's names or their husband's names, and they become fairly economically invisible. Someone like Evelyn De Morgan, who opens an account as Evelyn Pickering under her own name until her marriage with William De Morgan. After 3 years as Mrs. De Morgan, she disappears completely until De Morgan dies in 1917, when her name is added to the account. As you can see, the Mrs. is put up the top, that William De Morgan had held since his days as a student. So while it might have other advantages, having a husband who was also an artist often resulted in the woman relinquishing her relationship with her colourman, even when she was the more active artist. In 1874, when the painter and illustrator Adelaide Claxton married George Gordon Turner, variously described as gentleman, artist and manager of fine arts, she owed Robeson 9 shillings. This was transferred to an account her husband opened the following year, as he hadn't been an account holder before their marriage. It's assumed that the majority of the purchases listed were actually destined for Adelaide, but like Evelyn De Morgan, she doesn't appear as an account holder until her husband's death in 1905. And despite the anonymity of marriage, she appears to have been able to retain at least some of her identity. She's another artist who appears to have used her maiden name to exhibit, and she also used it for some of her rather interesting inventions, including the Claxton ear cap, an example of which is in the Science Museum in London, advertised under the slogan "No more ugly ears." When George Gordon Turner died, it therefore might have seemed more natural to Robeson to add a Claxton to the account than Mrs. Gordon Turner, although this may also be because they associated her more closely with Marshall Claxton, her father, who was also a long-standing account holder. The Married Women's Property Act of 1870 allowed women to own their own property and to inherit property and to be the legal owners of the money they earned for the first time. And it's very difficult to assess what effect this had and whether it's responsible for that peak we saw on the graph around the 1870s. And this is something I need to investigate further. One of the problems of actually investigating this is that half the female accounts in the Robeson archive are actually for unmarried women, and less than 5% go on to be married. This is not a reflection of the population at large, which is around the 14% mark never marry. So I think the profusion of single women is in part because there's an awful lot of young women who were occupying themselves with art as a pastime before they got married and never intended to pursue art as a career or any other career, probably. And a proportion of Robeson's single customers were also women who stopped working as artists once they married. And this includes Adelaide Claxton's sister Florence. She was the first female wood engraver for a weekly illustrated paper, but her account with Robeson stops in 1866, the year she married and largely gave up her career, one of the few other things she actually produces after her marriage is an anti-suffrage cartoon book called The Adventures of Women in Search of Her Rights. And motherhood is often cited as cutting short women artists' career, but marriage appears to be equally as effective. Several of the accounts held by single women are of very short duration, often of less than a year, or are represented by only a single purchase, hardly time to get married, really. But unmarried women also hold many of the longer-lasting accounts in the archive, and the duration of these accounts suggests that remaining single could result in a long working life, whether through opportunity or necessity. Painters from the period under discussion with the council lasting around 30 to 40 years include Edith Ackerman, Maud Beddington, Isabel Barclay, Mildred Ann Butler, Eleanor Hart Dyke, Maud Earle, Mariah Harrison, Lily Helsley, Blanche Jenkins, Anne Madeline Lewis, Beatrice Malcolm, Catherine Aulis, Edith Wanklyn and Mary Wedd. And there's a small number of unmarried women who held accounts for around 50 years or more, often painting well into their 70s and quite often until a few weeks before their deaths. These include the painters Rose Barton, Grace Hasty, Louise Hawkins, Helen Thornycroft and Emily Mary Osborne. And many of these long-standing customers remain almost completely obscure, despite what you would expect. Having such a long working life, you'd expect a large working output. And I was looking at Royal Academicians' accounts at this time just to see how they compared. And the average for a male Royal Academician is 25 years, although many of them actually do also have these long-standing accounts of 50 years or so. So I think you can see that unmarried women are working just as long as their male counterparts, but just to lesser claim. There are also married women who have long accounts, but often they're the ones who appear to be unusually successful, such as Lady Butler, Elizabeth Thompson, or they extend their working lives by teaching or writing, such as Mrs. E. M. Ward or Mrs. Russell Barrington, to use the professional names they preferred. This is just a screenshot of my database, which I'm working on, and I brought it with me, so if anyone wants me to look up any artists in which they're particularly interested, please do come and find me and I'll get it out of the locker. I'm still in the process of firmly identifying Robeson's customers, and I think about 20-25% are going to be entirely unknown, partly because 50 women have no addresses listed, and this is Miss Hall's entire account for 1865. This is her only record. Impossible to identify. There are a lot of Miss Halls around in 1865. But once identified, as far as I can, the occupational diversity of this sector of women in the 19th century art world should emerge. Even at this early stage of research, Robeson's customers cover a broad spectrum of female art workers. On top of what you'd expect, there's also early photographers, carvers and gilders, colour makers, writers, teachers, restorers, interior decorators and booksellers. And the geography of women artists has yet to be established, both within and outside London. The clustering of artists in certain areas of the capital is mapped in the Museum of London's Creative Quarters exhibition in 2001, but included almost no women. And the archive will show whether women artists were widely dispersed or established local networks in specific areas, as did men. It may also show whether women artists were able to support themselves sufficiently to live independently. You get an awful lot of unmarried artists still listed as living with their parents into middle age. This may be a reflection of social pressure on unmarried women to look after aged parents or not to live alone. But if for a woman who couldn't make a viable living from her brush, pencil, graver, chisel, it had the advantage of providing very low-cost accommodation. A long list of addresses over a short period is often an indication of potentially precarious finances. And although rented accommodation came at a price, some account holders took advantage of its temporary nature to leave without settling their debts. So Robeson's ledgers have endless instances of both single and married women basically doing a bunk and being investigated by private investigators and debt collection agencies and gone away, no address is very common. Very few of Robeson's female customers actually had separate studios, and many of them seem to combine their domestic and working spaces. And while household pressures are often cited as influencing women's choice of subject matter, encouraging them to paint their children, possessions or pets, the necessity of working from home would also have an impact on the size of the paintings that they were able to produce. The Robeson Archive lists purchases in details, including sizes of canvas. You can see a little sketch goes with it, down to an eighth of an inch. So further research will investigate whether women artists typically worked on a smaller scale than their male counterparts. Excuse me. The importance of size should not be underestimated. Frith, who was a master of public relations, fully appreciated the effect that large works might have on his public standing and wrote that he felt compelled to paint at least one large work a year for the sake of upholding and advancing my reputation and to attract notice amongst the crowds and crowded hang of the Royal Academy exhibition. Further work on the archival material will establish the personal and professional networks amongst which women artists worked, in particular the importance of family connections and connections to other artists. You often find a little recommendation when a new account is opened by women. But women frequently acted as referees for other women too, and it would be useful to explore how far women artists supported each other when there were relatively few in number, and whether this rise in women artists allowed them to have new opportunities as teachers, critics, and whether this was in an exclusively female sphere. So turning their backs on the sort of drawing classes advertised as for ladies by day, artists by night, women such as Louise Joplin and Lucy Kent Welsh opened their own schools to teach women at a professional level. Mrs. Ian Ward capitalised on her social connections to teach the daughters of the wealthy, and Louisa Gann superintended the Female School of Art in Queen Square and all held accounts with Robeson. Finally, another area to be investigated and where the Robeson Archive offers particularly rich material is research into amateur female artists. Robeson's customers included Queen Victoria and Queen Alexandra, and about 15% of the female account holders were titled. By the second half of the 19th century, many of the company's non-aristocratic customers also had the money and leisure to indulge in painting as a pastime. And you can see that Robeson's, how you wear this, I don't know, unless you've got a corset on, presumably. But you can see from Robeson's catalogue that their sketching apparatus was particularly designed, targeted towards women painting outside. And you often get this sort of equipment shown in these rather idealised depictions of sketching clubs for amateur women. It's very difficult to discriminate with any certainty between Robeson's professional and amateur women artists at a time when there were so many barriers preventing women from engaging in professional lives. This requires further research, and Robeson themselves found this very difficult. Eventually, in 1920, they scrapped the professional discount because so many people were claiming it and they couldn't really tell them apart. But by this stage, it was also the end of the golden age of the professional artist, and the future Robeson's customers were largely amateur. And by the 1920s, you can start to see this in the catalogues with the inclusion of materials such as lampshade painter and the rather alluring-sounding glitter wax. So they started to stock materials specifically aimed at the amateur artist. So a study of their account holders shows the Cullerman to be serving customers ranging from painting princesses to women who couldn't afford to pay their bills. More extensive research into this resource will provide information on the social origins and mobility, economic circumstance and geographic spread of a wide spectrum of women artists, and will help to untangle the interrelated networks amongst which they lived and worked as they tried to make a living from making art in 19th century London.